Lecture 24, Epilogue.
We've reached the end of our journey through the discovery of the early civilizations. And in this last lecture, I want to bring together some of the diverse threads of this long course. The first part of this lecture defines the three major stages of archaeological inquiry that resulted in the discovery of the ancient civilizations. We use three discoveries for this purpose to illustrate the point. The first of these is the finding of the Temple of Jupiter at Aena in Greece in the early 19th century. The second one are some remarkable find, some casualties from Middle Kingdom military engagement in Egypt. And finally, for the modern era, we examine the spectacular discovery of the Moche Lords of Sipan in Peru. In the second part of the lecture, we'll examine some of the essential similarities between the pre-industrial civilizations, such as the centralized government, intensified agriculture, common ideologies, and so on. Common features which are common to societies which only use human hands to survive and do not have the luxury of fossil fuels. We'll also stress that the discovery of the ancient civilizations reveals the astounding diversity of ancient human societies, a diversity as great, if not greater, than it is today. In this course, we've described the discovery of the ancient civilizations from every corner of the world. Yet we've barely scratched the surface of an enormous subject. All I can do at this point is bring all this together, the scientific progress made during these discoveries, by encapsulating them in the context of three important finds. In the year 1811, a traveller, Charles Robert Cockerell, an Englishman, visited the temple of Jupiter Palhellenius on the island of Aena in southern Greece. Cockerell intended to sketch and not much else, but he did some digging to expose some sculptures and unearthed a magnificent set of sculptures which had once adorned the pediment of the temple. He bought them from the local villagers for about $100. And he wrote a vivid account of how they were dug out and how in the evening they would party round a fire with the flickering flames and the smell of olive trees and pines around them. Very captivating, very light-hearted sort of expedition of young men. And he then took the sculptures, shipped them off the island against the opposition of the local authorities under the cover of darkness, and promptly turned round and sold them for a huge sum to the Prince of Bavaria. He made money. He was an adventurer, a casual visitor. To Cockerell and his successors, archaeology was a curiosity, a source of spectacular discoveries, and sometimes a way to make money, or to achieve fame like Giovanni Belzoni did, or Austin Henry Laird. This was the case through much of the 19th century. It took generations for a conscience to be born, and this conscience was born in the writings of Emilio Edwards, the traveller turned Egyptologist of the 1870s. It was born in the work of Arthur Evans and others. And a century after Cockerell, with his scandalous selling of those magnificent sculptures, an Egyptologist, Herbert Winlock, of the Metropolitan Museum of Fine Art in New York, who was instrumental to some degree in the discovery or interpretation of the tomb of Tutankhamun. He was the person who interpreted the funeral feast found by Theodore Davis in the Valley of Kings. He unearthed an underground chamber of Middle Kingdom Egyptian soldiers killed in battle. They had been buried at King Mentuhotep's mortuary complex on the west bank of the Nile, about 2010 BC. This, for the soldiers involved, was an extraordinary honor to be buried in the king's mortuary complex. Winlock cleared the sepulchre very carefully and examined the desiccated corpses with great care. He soon discovered that he had to move them out of the sun because directly he put them in the sun they began to smell and decompose. But by studying them in intricate detail, he was able to reconstruct the circumstances of their deaths. He is almost certain, for example, that these soldiers were killed by arrows fired downward from a fortification they were attacking because the angle of the wounds from the arrows was from above. He also pointed out that the attack was probably unsuccessful because the bodies lay on a battlefield and were then clawed and pecked at by scavengers like crows. There were wounds on the bodies. But then, subsequently, the attack was successful because the bodies were recovered and taken to the royal mortuary complex. He noticed the standardized hairstyles and pointed out that these were probably professional soldiers. Now, Winlock worked without the benefit of high technology science, but he was able to achieve an excellent reconstruction of a long-forgotten battle. This is a very different kettle of fish indeed from what Cockerill was doing, or from the excavations of Austin Henry Layard, who was looking for spectacular objects, even if he was interested in the study of the Assyrians, or the work of Heinrich Schliemann, who was determined to prove that Hissarlik was Troy without really too much care as to how he did it. So it was a major advance. Science was beginning to impact on the discovery of the ancient civilizations. There was a concern with detail, with reconstruction, with preservation. And then the third stage today is epitomized by one of the great archaeological discoveries of the 20th century. In 1989, a Peruvian archaeologist, and again here that it's a local archaeologist taking the lead here, a man called Walter Alva, was informed that looters at a pyramid at a place called Sipan on Peru's dry north coast had discovered a richly adorned burial. He was able to move in and rescue the site, from which he excavated the burials of three extremely wealthy, very important people. He called them the Lords of Sipan. They were leaders of the celebrated Moche civilization of the north coast of Peru. This was a civilization based on river valleys which dissect one of the driest environments on Earth. These river valleys are fed with water from meltwater from the high Andes inland. And in these river valleys, the Moche developed extremely elaborate irrigation systems. We know a considerable about the Moche because of their magnificent pottery, some of which includes portraits of rulers gazing serenely into the distance, captured on portrait vases. But the Sipan discovery completely revolutionized our knowledge of these people. The three lords were buried in their full regalia. This regalia took months to conserve and reconstruct in Peruvian and German laboratories. Walter Alva used fine-graved excavation, the latest conservation techniques, and recorded every detail of what was in the sepulchres. He showed how the lords were buried in their full regalia in cane coffins surrounded by sacrificial victims, large quantities of pottery, and magnificent regalia. This regalia had a polarity between gold and silver on one side of the body and gold on the other, sun and moon. He was able to dress a mannequin in a complete reconstruction of a Lord of Sipan's regalia. And it was a large headdress of gold. And you can imagine this figure. Again, like the Maya, public performance was important to the Moche. It was the way they validated their power. And you had these great pyramids, and you can imagine a ceremony where this lord in his full regalia would appear, and his regalia would glitter in the sun. He was the epitome of the sun god. God on earth. This reconstruction was very interesting because the Moche had no writing. And the only way they could figure out who these people were was by taking some of the painted designs on Moche pots and unrolling them with a camera, where you have a turntable and the pot turns and the camera exposes a scene which has been done round the pot as a long frieze. And they were able to show, thanks to the work of a man called Chris Donnan at UCLA, that these were probably warrior priests, war leaders and spiritual leaders who presided over the sacrifice of war prisoners in front of them on the pyramid. And this sacrifice, which involved the drinking of human blood, was a way of validating their authority. But here, notice the contrast between the very rough and ready way of the 19th century, the not-so-rough and ready ways of the earlier 20th century, and the science of the Lord of Sipan. Three stages chronicle the discovery of ancient civilizations. The first was an era of adventure and high drama, of rough and ready excavation, even looting, which led to the discovery of mainly lost civilizations. It led to the revealing of the Assyrians. It led to redefinition of the ancient Egyptians. It led to the discovery of the Minoans and the Mycenaeans, of Homeric Troy, of the Maya. But always at a tremendous cost in destruction. How much we lost in the 19th century is mind-boggling. And in many ways, psychologically, it's better not to dwell on it. This era lasted approximately from 1800 to 1880. One of the big side effects of this, of course, was the decipherment of Egyptian hieroglyphs and Mayan and Assyrian cuneiform, which were major advances. But nevertheless, the damage was irrevocable. Then came the second era, when archaeology came of age, with more precise excavation methods, a greater concern for smaller artifacts, for the dating of sites accurately, and for recording a finite archaeological resource which is vanishing. And also a new emphasis, not so much on the deeds of lords, but on the lives of common folk. This era began with the Germans at Olympia, with the work of General Pitt Rivers in England, continued with the pioneer excavation methods of Mortimer Wheeler, the work of Marshall in India, the early work on the Maya, and so on. But both excavation methods and scientific approaches were still crude by today's standards, and this era ended in about 1939. And since then, the third stage. Archaeology has become a science, with close connections to the humanities and the social sciences, where information is more important than finds, where some of the most spectacular discoveries have come from teeny detailed studies of minute facts, minute phenomena. For example, the whole study of the wine trade in the era of New Kingdom Egypt is absolutely fascinating. And this study is being conducted almost entirely from the residues in pots, something that would have been unimaginable even 50 to 60 years ago. We have today radiocarbon dating. We have the decipherment of Maya glyphs. We have all sorts of scientific techniques which enable us to examine the health of mummies, investigate minute details of ancient agriculture, and so on. The list goes on and on and on. But the point is this. We cannot berate the 19th century explorers because all science is cumulative. And the development of the study of ancient civilizations, of archaeology, has been a cumulative process. Each of these three stages grew out of an earlier one, as knowledge became more important than magnificent finds, the Lords less or as much as interesting as the commoners, depending on your perspective. 80 years after Tutankhamun's tomb, which really in many ways was a defining point for the discovery of ancient civilizations, we can identify many common features among them, which appear to be more than coincidence. So, after a century and a half, science is beginning us to show us the regularities, the commonalities, and the common features as we begin to achieve a better understanding of the dynamics of pre-industrial civilization. Not their treasures, not their monuments, not their lords, but the dynamics of societies which in some ways were as complex and in some ways probably more complex than our own. Let's look briefly at some of these commonalities. Every pre-industrial civilization, be it that of Egypt, Mesopotamia, Greece, China, the Indus, the Andes, every pre-industrial civilization was a social and economic pyramid with a supreme leader and a small nobility, an elite, if you wish, at the pinnacle, and the commoners, the laborers, the artisans, the soldiers, the priests, the petty officials, at the best, at the base. The many labored for the benefit of the few, and the power of those at the top depended on their ability to control the hands of those at the bottom of the pyramid. It was labor and control of information which were at the heart of the pre-industrial civilizations. A second common feature. Every pre-industrial civilization enjoyed and promulgated a compelling religious ideology. This ideology linked the lord and the commoner, the rulers and the ruled. It was an ideology that was communicated again and again and again and again through glyphs, through paintings, through art styles, through public ceremonies, through dance, through chant, through recitation. Why? Because only a teeny proportion of the population was literate. Everyone else had to rely on symbols. And in societies where information was passed from one generation to the next, almost entirely orally, such public manifestations of ideology were terribly important, as they are today. Go and look at the cathedral at Chartres, or St. Paul's Cathedral in London, and you will see the ideology of Christianity laid out in stone and above all in stained glass. And in the case of the pre-industrial civilizations, this compelling ideology almost invariably manifested itself in some form of divine leadership, where the king was seen as a living god, or the representative of the deities on earth. The Inca, the supreme ruler of the Inca, was its personification of the sun god on earth. The pharaoh was a divine king. Maya lords were powerful shamans, intermediaries with the deities, with a very special relationship with the complex and often menacing supernatural domain. This notion of specialness often manifested itself in rulers living apart, in isolation, making very carefully choreographed appearances, as did, for example, the pharaohs. Many of these lords, like the Chinese kings, had a special relationship with the ancestors, with the divine ancestors, with the royal ancestors, with those who went before. Because the notion of this was always continuity, the validation not only of civilization and society and of rule, but of life itself, the endless cycle of the seasons, harvest, dead time, rebirth, growth, harvest, death. This constant sequence, which in a way, dictated by the agricultural year, dictated also the passage of human life. So ideology was vital. But to validate this ideology, you required the settings. Almost all pre-industrial civilizations had some form of public buildings, be they a Minoan palace, be they a citadel, like that at Harappa and Mohenjo-daro, or a temple, like the magnificent temple of Amun at Karnak, adorned by generations of pharaohs, or the pyramids and shrines and plazas of Maya cities, which were replicas of the spiritual world and a setting for the great public ceremonies which validated life. One of the most important, for example, in ancient Egypt was the annual Opet ceremony, which saw the pharaoh pass in procession from the temple of Karnak to the temple of Luxor, the shrines of Amun, to communicate with the god and to assimilate the god's power once again. And another common feature, almost invariably, the architecture of cities and public precincts and sacred precincts made a statement about the world which revolved around this civilization. Maya cities, with their pyramids and their stelae and their lakes, were copies of a cosmos, of hills and forests, of lakes and swamps. The Aztec capital, Tenochtitlan, in highland Mexico, was also a statement of the supernatural world, a world laid out in quadrants, a world where each cardinal direction had a color and a meaning. At the center of the Aztec world was the grand temple of the rain god Tlaloc and the sun god Huitzilopochtli. The Inca capital at Cusco, high in the Andes, lay at the very center of Tahuantinsuyo, the land of the four quarters, the great domains of the Inca. And from there, the roads passed out along the quadrants of the state. Egyptian Thebes was a sacred landscape. All these places were the sort of center of the world. They were, in stone and stucco and wood and mud brick, a statement about the nature of the cosmos. Because always, all these societies were surrounded with intensely symbolic worlds which defined existence and the meaning of human life. Even the Aztecs, who lived, they said, in the world of the fifth sun, believed in a cyclical existence, an existence where one day their civilization would dissolve in chaos. And in the bizarre coincidence of history, Hernán Cortés achieved that for them. Some form of writing was common to all ancient civilizations except that of the Inca, but even they used an elaborate system of knotted strings for inventories and official messages. Only a few people in all these societies were literate or could decipher a quipu. These were the people who had access to information. They were, in their way, an elite, complete with their own hierarchies of knowledge. In ancient Egypt, there were specialist scribes, some of whom dealt with construction, others with agriculture, others with temple matters. To be literate was to have some form of power. To be a scribe was to be honored. And it was no coincidence that if a Maya lord caught a scribe from an opposing city, that scribe's hands were mutilated to prevent him writing any further. So power was carefully controlled. It was controlled by access to information. Because to have information about inventories, to have information was to control education. And information and conformity were power. Every civilization faced another problem, the issue of feeding its people. So some form of intensified and highly organized food production was essential to produce the food surpluses to support the ruler and the apparatus of government. This form of intensified agriculture took many different shapes. Among them were irrigation agriculture. For example, one of the great myths about ancient Egyptian civilization is that irrigation was one of the things which helped it form. In fact, large-scale irrigation did not begin until the Middle Kingdom, much later in the existence of Egyptian civilization. Then there was another form of intensification, organized trade in foodstuffs, or terrace farming on mountain slopes, and so on. The list of ingenious ways in which people increased agricultural production goes on for page after page. But the point is that, again, the weapon here, the issue, the way of control, was to control the administration of not basic foodstuffs, although these were vital, and obviously to feed your people was important, which the Egyptians learned the hard way. It was control of food surplus, the extra food. Food that enabled you to build temples, conduct ceremonies, raise armies and feed them, and so on. So control of food and information about food supplies translated into power. Standing armies, artisans, metallurgies, social classes. The list of common features between the pre-industrial civilizations is long. The point is this, to a great extent, these similarities are the product of the limited options available to pre-industrial civilizations where labor comes not from fossil fuels, but from human hands. But on top of this, we should realize that every ancient civilization was different. Each had its own distinctive religious beliefs, its technologies for the alloying of metals, its special weapons, its social and political institutions, which reflected the realities of their own local conditions and environments and traditional societies. It reflects a diversity of humankind which was as great as there is today, if not more so. The historical adventure of the discovery of the early civilizations continues to this day. Important discoveries are made almost yearly. For example, the recent discovery of a cemetery of mummies in the subsurface of a Lima shantytown in Peru. But what is noticeable is that local archaeologists are playing an important part now in this work. It is not now just foreigners coming in from remote lands, but it is the locals who are doing the work, which is how it should be. Because there is a commonality between archaeologists. Everywhere, archaeologists are continuing a quiet but urgent struggle against looters and against inexorable destruction of archaeological sites by grave robbers, by industrial activity, in an attempt to save the achievements of the world's first civilizations for future generations. The point is, as I've said again and again, is that the archaeological record is finite, and if we're not careful, it will have gone. And our grandchildren may not have it. In this lecture, we've described the three stages of the discovery of the ancient civilizations, the quest for spectacular finds, the increasing impact of science, and today's multidisciplinary approach to the study of early civilizations. And then I've gone on and described some of the common features of the early civilizations, the unifying ideologies, public architecture, intensification of agricultural production and writing. But most important of all, I've stressed that the similarities between these civilizations are the result of limited options, but that each had its own distinctive solutions to the problem of survival. In a way, this history has been a history of the discovery of the early civilizations at an early stage. What is exciting is what lies in the future.
We hope you've enjoyed these lectures from our Great Courses series. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at www.teach12.com or call our customer service representatives at 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Thank you very much.